Okay, now, chapter 36 doesn't really have, well, in a way, it doesn't have anything to do with the storyline we've been following. What it basically does, it shows what happened to Esau and primarily to his descendants. And you might say, well, why do we have to know about that? Because that's not the line of promise. But we have to remember he is a descendant of Abraham to whom God made significant promises. And so we want to see those promises fulfilled. And also, it does give us some interesting insight regarding the relationship with the Edomites and the Israelites, because Esau became the Edomites. So, first, the descendants of Esau, verses 1 to 8. The descendants. Now, these are the records of the generations of Esau, that is, Edom. Esau took his wives from the daughter of Canaan. So right away, you see that he's not living in accordance with someone who would want to protect the line of the promise, because he's marrying foreign women. But that's irrelevant to him, because he's not part of the line of promise. Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Deholabama, the daughter of Anna, and the granddaughter of Zibion the Hivite, and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Naboth. Ador bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basemath bore Reuel, and Oholibamah bore Jush, and Jalam, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. So there's the sons. Then Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all his household and all his livestock and all his cattle and all his goods which he had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to another land away from his brother Jacob. For their property had become too great for them to live together, and the land where they sojourned could not sustain them because of their livestock. So Esau lived in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. Does that remind you anything that happened elsewhere in the Bible? Remember Abraham and Lot, and the land couldn't sustain them? So they separated, and Lot took what looked to be the better land, and that's what Esau is doing. The land that Esau wanted in Seir was more fertile. Okay, notes. Esau had three wives, Adah, Oholibamah, and Basemath. Two of these wives' names, I'm going to have to change that sentence the way, this is how it should read. Two of these wives' names are not mentioned as listed earlier. Okay? Two of those three wives, their names are not mentioned the way they were mentioned earlier. Therefore, either those two wives died, or he just favored these names and took two different names. We're not sure what happened actually with those wives, because the scripture doesn't tell us. Now listen to this. Oholibamah was a great-granddaughter of Seir the Hittite, whose descendants were living in Edom when Esau went there. From these wives, Esau had three sons. Now, Seir the Hittite, if you do the calculation, what I come out with is that Esau married his great-great-granddaughter. Right? Because Oholibamah was the great-granddaughter of Seir the Hittite, and their daughter's name was, well, Oholibamah was the name of the great-granddaughter of Seir, who was Esau's son, and Israel had a wife with her and married that wife. So actually Esau married his great-great-granddaughter. It's so weird. It's such a different time from where we live. First of all, it's interesting to me that people, because the people had such long lives back then compared to us, it was not unusual for a person to still be living on the earth when their great-great-grandchildren were born. It's not like today where usually a person dies after they see their grandchildren, maybe some great-grandchildren for a little while. And here we got Esau marrying his great-great-granddaughter. The narrative stresses two elements. First, Esau's sons were born in the land of Canaan, and he moved to Seir. This contrasts sharply with Jacob, whose children had children out of the land and moved into the land. And there's significance to that, because this is the land of promise. And it appears as though Esau has resolved himself to the fact that he's not going to be the chosen one. And he sees that that's God's choice, and he's accepting it now. And so he didn't move into the promised land. He moved out of it. On the other hand, Jacob, whose children were born out of the land, moved into the land, which signifies that he knew that he was in the line of promise. And so he moved into the promised land at that time. So there is some significance there. In fact, all through the chapter, the reader is reminded of this. Certainly Israel would understand the import of this because she often struggled with Esau's descendants. Constant struggle with the Edomites who were Esau's descendants. The wording of verse 7 is striking. One thinks of Lot. The land was not able to bear both of them because their herds were so great. Esau, like Lot, left for the east and greener land. Okay. There's one. The succession of Esau, father of the Edomites. I don't know why that goes to 37:1, but let me see something. Yeah, it really should go to the last verse in the chapter. So that's right away we got a typo. Okay, let's go. Verses 36 through the end of the chapter. 9 to the end of the chapter. Then are the records of the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites, in the hill country of Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Esau's wife Adah; Reuel, the son of Esau's wife Basemath. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, and Gadam and Kenaz. When I read these names, it's like I'm reading the name of, you know, Groucho Marx and his brothers, Zeppo, and it's like I'm reading their names. Timnah was a concubine of Esau's son Eliphaz, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Esau's wife Adah. These are the sons of Reuel: Nathan and Zerah, Shammah and Mizpah. These were the sons of Esau's wife Basemath. These were the sons of Esau's wife Olibamah, the daughter of Anah and the granddaughter of Zibeon. She bore to Esau Jeush and Jalam and Korah. These are the chiefs of the sons of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esau, are Chief Teman, Chief Omar, Chief Zepho, Chief Kenaz, Chief Korah, Chief Gadam, and Chief Amalek. These are the chiefs descended from Eliphaz in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Adah. These are the sons of Reuel, Esau's son, chief Nahath and Zerah, chief Shammah, chief Mizah. These are the chief's descendants from Reuel in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Basemath. These are the sons of Esau's wife, Olabama, chief Jesh, chief Olam, Jalam, chief Korah. These are the chiefs descended from Esau's wife, Olabama, the daughter of Anna. These are the sons of Esau, that is Edom, and these are their chiefs. These are the sons of Seir the Horite, the inhabitants of the land, Lotan and Shobal and Zibeon and Anna, and Dishon and Ezer and Dishon. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites, the sons of Seir in the land of Edom. Boy, this is a long chapter. What are you going to do? The sons of Lotan were Hori and Heman, and Lotan's sister was Timnah. These are the sons of Shobal, Alva and Manath, and Ebal and Shepho and Onam. These are the sons of Zibeon, Ai and Ana. He is the Ana who found the hot springs in the wilderness when he was pasturing the donkeys of his father Zibeon. These are the children of Anna, Dishon and Holabama, the daughter of Anna. These are the sons of Dishon, Hemdan and Eshban and Ithran and Charon. These are the sons of Ezer, Bilhan and Zavin and Achan. These are the sons of Dishon, Uz and Aran. These are the chiefs descended from the Horites, chief Lotan, chief Shobal, chief Zibeon, chief Anna, chief Dishon, chief Ezer, chief Dishon. Chief is somewhat synonymous with king here, the ruler of the tribe. And these were more like tribes than big like metropolitan cities. These were different tribes. Now these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the sons of Israel. So notice, they had settled in the land, not the land of promise. It's been accepted by Esau that he does not inherit the land of promise. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, and the name of his city is Dinhabah. Then Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, became king in his place. Then Jobab died, and Husham of the land of the Temanites became king in his place. Then Hushman died, and Ahaz became the son of Bedad, who defeated Midian in the field of Moab, became king in his place, and the name of his city was Avith. Then Hadad died, and Samlah and Masrekah became king in his place. Then Samlah died, and Shaul of Rehoboth on the Euphrates River became king in his place. Then Shaul died, and Balaam, the son of Achor, became king in his place. Then Balanan, the son of Achor, died, and Hador became king in his place. And the name of his city was Paw. Possibility I'm not pronouncing that correctly. But let me check something. It might be Pi. Okay. And his wife's name was Metabel, the daughter of Matred, daughter of Mesahab. Now these are the names of the chiefs descended from Esau, according to their families and localities, by their names: chief Timnah, chief Alva, chief Jeth, chief Olabama, chief Elah, chief Pinon, chief Kenaz, chief Teman, chief Mizbar, chief Migdal, chief Iram. These are the chiefs of Edom, that is, Esau, the father of the Edomites, according to their habitations in the land of possession. In the land of their possession. Now, that's all. Moses just puts that chapter in there. As we're going through the story with Jacob and everything, it's the Jacob story. And all of a sudden, he sticks this chapter in, and he gives us the genealogy, the descendants of Esau. Why does he do that? Well, he does that for three reasons. First of all, it's a very good way, instead of going into a whole lot of, although it was wordy, it's the most efficient way to just demonstrate that God kept the promises he made to Esau. Actually, he made those promises to Esau's mother, Hagar. Remember when she said, nations will come from your son? Look at this. Look at the nations. And these were all nations. They weren't big like the United States. And they settled in Edom. Secondly, it shows us that the land of promise is for the descendants of Jacob, and outside of the land of promise is the land for Esau, and that he accepted that. That the line of promise was through Jacob. Okay? But bear in mind something. When we think about population growth, these people had very large families, didn't they? And you know, like if you think of population growth today, you say, well, you get a man and a woman to get married. They have two kids, maybe three. Yeah, I don't see any more than that. Mostly two now these days. Those two get married and have two children each. So that's four in that generation. Then each of those gets married and has two children each. That's eight from that one, right? But here, two people get married and they have like 12 children. And then each of those gets married and has 12 children. Right away, the guy, the original guy, has 144 grandchildren in the second generation. So you can see how fast population can grow. It can grow within just a few. It does not take a long time to replace. After the flood, people say it must have taken centuries to replace the earth. A few years. Not a long time. Same thing in the millennium. It doesn't take long, because of the way population grows, to replenish the earth. And the same, when Adam and Eve were told, be fruitful and multiply, that was an easy thing to do. Because you got to remember, while we're counting all these people who are descendants of the original two are still having children. They live to an old age. So you can imagine how large this family would be after like 10 generations. It would be like a tribe. It would be a tribe with a leader. Have you ever seen, I've seen them, pictures of families where the people in the family seem to have longevity, and I've seen pictures like this where the whole family gets together for Thanksgiving, and right in the center is this little old lady, and she's the great-great-great-grandmother. And she's surrounded by her family, her husband, and then her children, and then her great-grandchildren, and then her grandchildren, then her great-great-grandchildren, and a few great-great-great-grandchildren. So from this one woman, you have a lot of people, and in not that long a time period. So population can grow very, very quickly. Okay?
Okay, the succession of Esau, the father of the Edomites. The latter part of chapter, and that should be 36, not 6. See where it says chapter 6? Should be 30. What? You don't have chapter 36? I don't know what to tell you. We're handing around the piece of paper at the break. And anybody who doesn't have any chapters up through 30, well, this I can give you.
Anybody who doesn't have any chapters, everybody should have through chapter 39 now. So anything you're missing from 1 to 38, you're going to write it on with your, put your name and the chapter number you need, and then I'm going to have them print them. But everybody now has 39, that we know. Okay. The latter part of chapter 36 is a minor division of, doesn't belong there, within the account of what happened to Esau. The sons of Esau also had sons. Thus Esau had 5 sons and 10 grandsons, either literal descendants or tribes founded by them. Esau had 11 grandsons if Korah is included in verse 16. If we include him, it's 3 more. Perhaps he is excluded from the list because he died soon after becoming a chief. In the Hebrew, each of the 10 grandsons, 13 at all, lists the sons, that is, the sons, grandsons, and daughters of Seir the Horite, inhabitants of the land. The sons were probably aboriginal Edomites. That means people who originally lived on the land conquered by Esau. So Esau was like the overlord, and these men became lords or kings or whatever terminology you want to use. Seir's 7 sons became Horite chiefs. From these came 20 sons and daughters. One of Esau's wives was Oholibama, a great-granddaughter. I think it's great-great-granddaughter. I'm going to check that again. Oholibama, a great-granddaughter of Seir. Seir gave birth to Zibeon, who bore Anna, whose daughter was Oholibama. It is not clear how the kings of Edom were related to Esau, but they were kings who reigned in Edom, and Esau is Edom. In other words, it was his land. So we're not sure how he related to the aboriginal people, but obviously he was an overlord in that land. The organization of clans in Edom apparently paralleled that in Israel. They ultimately chose a king from one of the tribes and carried on a succession from him. Whether or not the line of 8 kings mentioned here extends beyond the time of Jacob is unclear. The point is comparative, though. There were no kings in Edom before any Israelite reigned. Cross out the next chapter, shouldn't even be there. And so we can see that before Israel even had a king in Israel, the Edomites were settled in the land of Edom, and they had kings. Okay? Verses 40 to 43 list the names of the chiefs who descended from Esau according to their families after their places by their names. Esau was thus a great, powerful overlord, the father of the Edomites. Okay. Now again, this chapter does not follow the storyline. Now we're going to go, it was put in there because one of the things people say, whatever happened to Esau and the promises that were made to him, and what did happen to him, and where does he stand on the line of promise, and whatever happened to that, and God's promises to him, and plus the fact he was a child of Abraham, so you would be interested in whatever happened to him. And what happened is he multiplied like rabbits, they multiplied. And in a short amount of time, Esau grew into Edom, which was the land in which the Edomites settled. That's the descendants of Esau and the original Edomites. And he conquered that whole land, and that's where they lived, and that's where they had their tribes. And eventually the tribes would get, you know, the tribes would, what's the word? They would have a king over themselves, and each tribe would still have a chief. Okay. But so now when we go to chapter 37, we're back into the Jacob story. A little louder, I can't.
The Arab nations are from Esau.
I have to go ask Bob if they're from Esau or Ishmael. I think they're from Esau, but I want to make sure of that. I'm going to do it during the break. I've already decided it because I always forget. I want to make sure that they're from Esau and not from Ishmael. But I do know that the nations from that came forth, the tribes that came forth from Esau and Israel had strife and problems all the time. Okay, chapter 37, Jacob in the land, verse 1. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. Jacob in the land. Verse 1 actually begins narrative to the preceding Jacob narrative. In other words, 35. If you remove chapter 36, then the transition between chapter 35 and 37 is very smooth because you're right back where you were going. It records the conclusion of the Jacob story and readies the reader for the Joseph story. It shows Jacob back in the land of promise, but still dwelling there as a sojourner like his father. Moses' point is to show the reader that the promises of God have not yet been completely fulfilled and that Jacob, like his fathers before him, was still awaiting their fulfillment. It is from a verse such as this that the writers of the Brit Chadashah saw the patriarchs as aliens and strangers on the earth, Hebrews 11:13. In other words, to a very large extent, when God said that the nation of Israel, I'm going to give you this nation, they knew that that was not the fulfilled promise. They were just traveling through. They'll receive the fulfilled promise. Because remember, there's other things promised them aside from the land. Forgiveness of sin, having everyone knowing him, not having to go into others to teach them about him. You know, the blessings in Jeremiah 31. And so, here, we can see that these men, it's called the Hall of Faith. It's in Hebrews 11, and it goes through the patriarchs and show how they were all faithful, and it shows how they all recognized that they were just passing through this land, this life, looking for a better land, promised them by God. This verse also provides a fitting transition to the next session, section, the Joseph narratives, which trace the course of events by which the sons of Jacob left the land of promise and entered Egypt. According to 25:11, Jacob's father, Isaac, dwelt in Beer Lahai-Roi, which is evidently where Jacob lived at this time. By the way, what I think I'm going to do, because it's not really going to take very much longer, you know sometimes how in the Bible, chapter divisions and verse division and all so forth break up a narrative kind of? Well, if you didn't end Genesis at chapter 50 and continued right on with Exodus 1, you wouldn't know that Exodus 1 starts a new book. The narrative just continues very smoothly along. And it continues very slowly along for the first 19 chapters of Exodus. We have the story of the Exodus. So I think we won't stop at 50. Won't take us too long, but we'll do those extra 19 chapters. At the end of those 19 chapters, that's when the law begins, and that's when we'll stop. You know, the building of the tabernacle. Okay, let's see how we're doing. Okay, great. Okay, chapter 37. reading in verse 1. Let me just start reading from verse, in notes from verse 1 again. Now I don't have to start from verse 1. Okay, number 5. The story of Joseph in Egypt forms a unique literary unit in the book of Genesis. The fact that there are repeated elements in the narratives does not prove the material was handed down in two differing traditions, as many critical scholars claim. Some critical scholars, there are various places in the Bible where things are repeated. And we don't do that today. In our literature, in high school, if you handed in an essay and you wrote a paragraph, and then somewhere else in the essay you wrote the same paragraph, you would get marked down for that. But that's not how these people looked at it. The way they looked at it is if you wanted to emphasize something, you repeat it. For example, remember when Peter, went to the Gentile man's house and he led the Gentiles to the Lord. Right? Remember when he saw the blanket come down from God with all the animals on it? And at the same time, this guy was having the visions in some other town that Peter's going to, so they went and got Peter. Well, Peter tells that story in its entirety twice. In its complete, and in fact, the second time he tells it is in chapter 15, when they're deciding whether or not Gentiles should be included, and he tells them the whole story he goes over again. And the reason for that is because that's big. It's something to be emphasized, especially in those days. Especially in those days. I mean, we're so far removed from that historically that it's hard for us to conceive of it. But now the question is, did Jews believe in Jesus, right? Back in the first century, when the church was first started, the big question and the big date was, should Christians be Gentiles? This history does flip-flop sometimes on you. Words are repeated in those languages. Like, we would never say, I will never, never leave you. That's bad English. It's a double negative. But in the Bible, they do use double negatives because they don't look at language as mechanically as we do. They don't apply strict laws of logic to their language because they realize that language is not an exact science, it's also an art. And so they allow authors, I mean, there are obviously rules, talk about rules, take some Greek and Hebrew courses, and there are rules to make accurate communication, but redundancy for the sake of emphasis is permissible in the ancient languages. Okay, one example of repetition is the analogy between the Jacob and Joseph stories. Both cycles of narratives begin with the father being deceived and the brothers being treacherous. Now think about Jacob and Joseph. No, think about the Jacob and think about Joseph. The fathers were deceived in both stories, right? And the brothers were both treacherous. They wiped out a whole town, and then the next generation, they wanted to kill their own brother. Both cycles include a 20-year period of separation with the younger brother in a foreign land. Jacob with Laban in Haran, and Joseph in Egypt, 20 years. Both conclude with a reunion and a reconciliation. As God had worked out matters to a proper resolution with Jacob, he would do the same with Jacob's son, Joseph. The Joseph stories were also instructive for Israel. As Joseph spent years in bondage in Egypt, so the descendants would be in bondage there and would be delivered from it. For Joseph, the discipline would test his faith, for the nation of Israel to stay in Egypt would be for their preservation and discipline. So you see, I'm not saying that it was right, of course, what Pharaoh did. What he did was wrong. But God was in control of the circumstances, and he's going to watch over his people. And the sad truth is, but it is a truth, the Jewish people were better off in slavery in Egypt than living out somewhere where they would be attacked by a band of marauding thief killers. You know, it was dangerous then. And he was able to use Egypt as a safe incubator for his people to turn them into a nation. Now, once he turned them into a nation, then they could leave Egypt because they were like 3 million strong. And they were powerful, and the nations were all scared of them. That's right. He didn't want them because they did that when they had the opportunity. They did that. Judah did it with Tamar. Okay. The selling of Joseph into Egypt, 2 through 36. All right, now we start with Joseph, Jacob's favorite son, verses 2 to 4. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock of his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wife. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Okay, so in the notes, as the Joseph story begins, Joseph is introduced. It shouldn't be in, it should be is. Joseph is introduced and his obedient 17-year-old son who brought back a bad report about his half-brothers. Though doing this has never been popular, it shows that Joseph was a faithful servant. Naturally, his brothers hated him for this. Joseph was also honored by Jacob, who gave him a richly ornamented tunic. This seems to indicate that Jacob favored Joseph above all the rest, and worst of all, with the intent of giving him all or a larger portion of the inheritance. That really bothered them. So he said, let's get rid of this guy. Okay. Verses 5 through 11, Joseph's dreams. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Then the brother said to him, are you actually going to reign over us, or are you really going to rule over us? Now they hated him more for his dreams and for his words. Now he had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, lo, I have had another dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. He related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow down ourselves before you to the ground? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Now, if you picture it, his first dream, I'll explain this before we go to notes. Joseph and his brothers were representative sheaves of hay. You know, when they would bundle hay into sheaves. Today, when they do it in these like big blocks. You ever see that? But they used to put them in bundles, like round bundles. And so there were these bundles, and Joseph was represented by one of the bundles. And all the other bundles bowed down to him. And the brothers got the meaning. They bowed down, all the other brothers' bundles bowed down his bundle. Then in the next one, the sun, the moon, and the stars bowed down to him. And in ancient civilizations, heavenly bodies often represented people. And Israel got the Isaac got the message. The sun was the father, the moon was his mother, and the stars were his brothers. So, and the interesting thing is, in the first instance, it gives us a kind of clue as to how this is going to happen, because the first section is agricultural, and that's how it happened. It happened because of what was going on agriculturally at the time. They slipped into a famine. Okay, Joseph dreams. God confirmed Jacob's choice of his favorite son by two dreams. God's revelation was given in different forms in the Tanakh. He used dreams, which should be there, when his people were leaving or outside the land, that is, in the lands of pagans, and that people were about to leave to go in the land of pagans. In a dream, God announced to Abraham the Egyptian bondage. In a dream, God promised protection and prosperity for Joseph in his sojourn with Laban. And by two dreams, God predicted that Joseph would rule over his family, which, of course, as we know, came true. The brothers hated Joseph all the more and were jealous of him, but Jacob pondered the matter. He knew how God works. He was well aware that God could select the younger to rule over the elder, and that God declared it should be his choice by an oracle or a dream. The scene of the first dream was agricultural. There may be some hint of the manner of Joseph's authority over his brother, another word's missing. I might as well just hand out a typewriter to everybody. All the more. The scene of the first dream was agricultural. There may be some hint here of the manner. No, that's all right. Here of the manner of Joseph's authority over his brothers would be achieved through a famine, through something agricultural. Joseph's sheaf of grain was upright while their sheaves bowed down to him. The scene of the second dream was celestial. The sun, moon, and 11 stars bowed down to him. In ancient cultures, astrological bodies should be in their represented rulers. The dream then symbolically anticipated the elevation of Joseph over the whole house of Jacob. Joseph's father, the sun, his mother, the moon, his 11 brothers, the stars. Sensing that Joseph was to be elevated to prominence over them, the envy of his brothers was understandable. However, their reaction in contrast with Joseph's, should just be in contrast, Joseph's faith, that "and" shouldn't be in there. Faithfulness demonstrated why Jacob's choosing was proper. God's sovereign choice of a leader often brings out the jealousy of those who must submit. Rather than recognize God's choice, his brothers set on a course to destroy him. Their actions, though prompted by the belief that they should lead, shows why they should not have led. Okay, now the sale of Joseph. Sarah was dead, and Abraham by this point, but Sarah doesn't record yet that she died. Did it? She what? He's only 17. I don't see any record here of his wife having died. Jacob's wife. Oh, Jacob's mother was dead, but his wife wasn't. Okay. Okay. The sale of Joseph. Verses 12 through 36. Okay. Where are we? Turn back there. I'm going to go to 38. Verse 41. 36. Okay, verses 12 through 36. Now, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Joseph went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah and his friend Herah the Adullamite. It was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to share his sheep." Well, what am I reading? What am I doing? I'm losing my mind. Yeah, I know that. Well, it's actually going to be, that's 140, yeah, 141, right? I just was reading from the wrong page of my Bible, and all of a sudden I said, what's going on around here? We want to be reading in chapter 38, verses 12 through 6. Chapter 37. Right, okay, here we go, got it. I know it all the time, by the way. Okay, ready? Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come and I will send you to them. And he said to them, I will go. I wonder what that was like. Like, you wake up in the morning, right, with sunrise. You have a little bowl of porridge, wash your face. Then you put on your clothes and you get your staff. And you have your little bag of water here. And you have your lunch or your food here. And you also have something that probably rolls on wheels. No, you don't need that. And then you take all the sheep, so you just take the sheep out where you think will be good pasture, and you find pasture for them. And you build a little one of those things we talked about where the sheep can go in and out. They can go in and be safe, go out and find pasture. And you let the sheep graze for a while, and they play, and you watch out for them. And then at the end of the day, you take them in, put them back in, and go and lie and deceive everybody in your family, which results in World War I and World War II. Okay, ready? No, but I must have been a nice life. All these people became so wealthy. Boggles my mind. Okay, where were we?
No competition.
I didn't finish this one. I had my coronary. Wait. Chapter 37. Right. Then he said to them, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock and bring word back to me. So he sent them from the valley of Hebron and he came to Shechem. A man found him and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, what are you looking for? He said, I am looking for my brothers. Please tell me, where are they pasturing the flock? Then the man said, they have moved from here, for I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. When they saw him from a distance and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. This is some, I want to get adopted into his family. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. They just wanted to kill this guy. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. But then let us see what will become of his dreams. But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, let us not take his life. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into the pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to their father. So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very cold tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him in the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal. Can you imagine? Brothers dying in a pit, and you sit down, I had time for lunch. What'd you do this morning? I murdered my brother, had lunch. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, the caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother and their own flesh." His brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed on, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. He turned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in blood. Then he examined it and said, "This is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of his bodyguard. Boy, Joseph led some life, I'll tell you. If anybody ever said to me, in the Bible, who led really fascinating lives? I mean, they all did, but Joseph, to go from in a pit to ruler in Egypt. Moses, from going a murderer, running away from possible death sentence, to the greatest prophet in the history of the world. And who else did I have in mind? I have somebody else in mind. Okay. The occasion for selling Joseph was when he obediently went to his brothers near Dothan to inquire about their welfare. See how the word "was" should be there between Joseph and when? In spite of the hatred he knew they had for him, he complied with his father's wishes. The brothers devised a plot to kill Joseph so that his dreams would not be fulfilled. Before, they plotted to kill many Shechemites in revenge for their sister. Now, by contrast, they plotted to kill their own brother. You know, sometimes when I'm reading like a long list of names like we did when we were in the Esau thing, it's like I'm speaking in tongues. And it's like if they were all sitting here watching me, they'd say, "How do you say, well, who's that? That's not how I pronounce my name. Where did you come from?" Okay. Where was I? Okay, the brothers deceived a plot to kill Joseph so that his dreams would not be fulfilled. Before they plotted to kill many Shechemites in revenge for their sister. Now, by contrast, they plotted to kill their own brother. Reuben, trying to gain an opportunity to restore Joseph to Jacob, persuaded his brothers not to commit such a crime. He suggested they throw Joseph alive into a cistern. Reuben thought he could come back and rescue Joseph later. So the brothers stripped Joseph of his tunic and threw him into a dry cistern to die. That'd be horrible to be down, you know, it's too deep for you to climb out of. And you just sit there till you die.
Well, he was. That's a possibility. He was the firstborn. Reuben was the firstborn. But don't remember, it was also Reuben and Levi who did the carnage at Shechem, and that caused Reuben to lose his blessing in chapter 29. So he wasn't really in good standing. And although Reuben was the firstborn, that doesn't really have any effect on future generations, because, for example, we know that kings came from the tribe of Judah and priests came from the tribe of Levi.
But maybe that's why he thought David couldn't be Jacob, because
we can speculate, and that might be true. Okay, the brothers deceive Jacob, verses 29 to 35. That's strange. There's never any deception in this book. Okay, verses 29 to 35. Ah, here we go. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. For me, where am I to go?" I read this already, didn't I? Yeah, I just got to read it in the notes. I didn't read it in the notes. Okay, so it's the bottom of page 141. The theme of deception surfaced again in the family. Here, Jacob was deceived by his own sons. The sons dipped Joseph's tunic in goat's blood to deceive Jacob into thinking Joseph was dead, devoured by a ferocious animal. Jacob mourned greatly over the loss of his beloved son. Unknown to the brothers, Joseph was not dead. Rather, he was sold to Potiphar, Potiphar's captain of the guard. Okay, let's see where we are. Okay. The amazing thing here is the story that we're reading. Can you imagine if God was completely removed from this story? It never would have been. First of all, Abram would have lived his life out in Ur and died there. So that's number one. But when we read through this, we can see God was continually getting them out of trouble and holding this thing together, because he intended to bring blessing upon the human race, and he intended to do it through his chosen people. And that's the way it is. And you know something? If somebody says to me, I mean, it's so unbiblical that I laugh how unbiblical it is. But when somebody says to me, God has replaced Israel with the church, one thing I say to them is, then you take all the Old Testament prophecies concerning a future Israel, literally or not, allegorically. They have to say allegorically. We say, they come literally. I say, well, then the church hasn't replaced it. They take them allegorically as applying to the church. But the other thing is, man became alienated from God because of sin. And God raised up the Jew to give to the world a blessing, redemption. And he did it by giving us the Bible and the Messiah. Those are the two essential instruments of blessing and salvation. And he chose to do it through a people he chose, the Jewish people. And continually, since the Jewish people have become a people, the non-Jewish world has been doing everything they could to destroy them, their source of salvation. Because who hates Israel? Satan. Boy, I'm glad I'm not Hitler. Can you imagine being Hitler?
As you wrote, you phrased that it's unknown to the brothers. Joseph was not dead. You don't mean unknown to the brothers.
Yeah, they didn't know he was not dead.
I didn't, you know.
Where is it that you're looking at? I got to get it.
Yeah, I'm going to get it. Yeah, Joseph probably did. Oh, you know something? That's a mistake. It shouldn't say unknown to the brothers. It should say unknown to Esau. Esau thought he was dead. Thanks for that correction. See what I'm saying? Jacob, right, Jacob. Jacob thought he was dead, but he wasn't. The brothers knew he wasn't. Very observant. Okay, let's see where we are here.